I sure hope you're hungry.
Ooh, I'm starving.
Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that O-shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today we have a guest on, which I am very amazed that we get to have on. We have Eric Meyer on, who is extremely prominent figure in CSS world. He's been responsible for a lot of the stuff that has come to CSS over the many decades, and is author of many books. I'm pretty sure you wrote the original CSS 1 testing spec? What was that called?
Yeah, the CSS 1 test suite.
Which the browsers would point towards that to make sure they have implemented CSS correct.
Yeah, that was the idea anyway.
Yeah, unreal. So I'm sure I'm missing a lot of the stuff out here, but I'm sure most people already know who Eric Meyer is. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So why don't you give the audience a quick rundown of who you are, what you do, and maybe some of the large things you've been involved in over your career.
Gosh, there's been a lot. So I started out as a burger flipper way back in the day. First job, McDonald's, like everybody. Yeah, specifically, I was working at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I still live, and that's where I graduated from. And as soon as I graduated, I managed to land a job on the theory that I would try to make back all of the money I had given them in tuition, which I actually did. It took years, but I managed. Anyway, I was a hardware jockey for the libraries, installing computers and stuff, and making sure that they worked, and replacing the RAM when students stole it, which happened at least once.
Holy smokes!
Around about that time, there was a colleague who's also a friend was telling us that we really had to check out this new thing called Mosaic, and I was like, whatever, right? It's another one of his little enthusiasms. But then I actually got to try it and was immediately taken. So I quickly became the webmaster there at Case back when we were called webmasters. This is 1993, 1994 is what I'm talking about here. Yeah. In fact, wow. 5th of December, I think it was 30 years ago today, I marked up my first HTML document.
Really? Wow. Wait, 30 years ago? Because yesterday, December 4th, was the 28th birthday of JavaScript. So this was 2 years before JavaScript was even a thought.
Indeed. This was
wow.
At least a year before there were tables on web pages. Like, table markup did not exist. But anyway, while I was there, I got to help the university get stuff online. And then I also managed to get the university to send me to some conferences to present some papers. And at one of them, there was a presentation about this newfangled technology called CSS that browsers didn't support yet, but they were about to. And that blew me away. So I got really interested. In the course of trying to learn CSS, things kept not working the way that I thought they should from reading the spec. And so I started setting up these simple test pages to just figure out, like, do I understand what margin means, right? Or do I, like, is this browser just not recognizing what padding is? And that evolved into the CSS1 test suite that I shared with a working group. They were super interested. They shared it with browser makers, and it eventually became the first official W3C test suite. I got some help. Let me be clear. This is not like a solo, hermit genius kind of whatever. Like Tim Boland at the National Institute of Standards and Technology helped out. Chris Lilly's from the CSS working group, other CSS working group members contributed what we would now call bug reports, but in those days was sending me emails saying, oh, this one's wrong. like you did not understand how that particular thing worked. So I would fix it. And then Todd Farner created the acid test, which was made part of the test suite. Around about the same time, I started writing the first edition of CSS, The Definitive Guide for O'Reilly. And it has now recently had a fifth edition. So, and here, let me show you visual difference for those. So here's the first edition, right? Here's the fifth edition.
You can just tell by the lift.
Yeah, the fifth edition is at least three of the first edition. This was like 400 Holy. Pages. This is 1,100 and some.
Yeah, and back then it was Mosaic, which eventually became Netscape Navigator. But like IE wasn't a thing back then. Was that the only browser at the time?
At the point where I encountered CSS, which is 1996. Yes, 1990, like summer of 90, spring of 96 I was at this conference. And actually the only browser that at the time was supposed to support any CSS was IE3, but then the guys at Netscape heard about it. And so Netscape Navigator 4, they started to implement stuff, some of it incorrectly. I still recall with fondness the time that I explained to an engineer who shall remain nameless at Netscape that pikas did not mean 1/144th of an inch. They were actually like 12 points. They had misread it. They thought a pika was 1/12th of a point instead of 12 points. Not that anybody uses pikas or points, but whatever. That in some ways that makes it more sort of dear to my heart, because it was completely like nobody's ever going to use this, but we're still, damn it, we're going to get it right.
Yeah.
As part of trying to figure out like what browsers did what correctly or didn't support at all or whatever, I started to create these charts, these tables. For anyone who, like, the easy way to visualize this is imagine if you had caniuse.com, except as a single table that listed everything. Now, at the time, I was only listing the properties in CSS1, which is like 70 properties or something. It wasn't that huge, but it was still a big old like yes no partial buggy is how I coded things, and it was YMPB. I color coded them, and I just started publishing this for free because I was like, I have this test suite, so I know what browsers are doing. Why don't I just put it up there for people? So I did. And that led to Dale Doherty at Web Review contacting me and saying, we would love to publish these at Web Review. Would that be okay? And I said, that would be awesome. And if you ever need anyone to write anything about CSS, let me know. And he said, actually, we would love to. And here's what we pay per article. And I remember reading that email and thinking, wait, they're going to pay me for this?
Yeah.
Not that it was a lot. I mean, but they were going to pay me to write these articles. So that's what led to me actually ending up writing the O'Reilly book was... It turned out that Web Review had their cubicles right next to the O'Reilly cubicles. And so one day the O'Reilly people were having lunch with the Web Review people and said, do you know anybody who knows anything about the CSS thing? Because we think that maybe we should write a book, publish a book or something. They said, yes.
Wow. It's wild how that stuff kind of snowballs, right? That opportunity snowballed into the other one. At that time, when you're picking up CSS, is the only way to learn it via the spec itself, or was that it? Yeah.
Yep, pretty much. Certainly in 96, people did start to write, you know, tutorials and articles relatively soon. And I mean, I say that being one of the people who's writing the articles, but it was pretty much reading the spec. But the spec was like 70 pages or something. It was not huge. Yeah, it wasn't densely technical the way W3C specs are now. And not that I think that the way they are now is a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. The dense technicality of the specs, there's so much detail that when someone goes to implement something, it's all spelled out. Like, this is what it should do. And if there's a particular algorithm to figure it out, this is what that is. You know, so for like grid layout. But at the time, the specs were, here's what margin is, and here's a property for it. Like, not describing in detail like how you should run the calculations to do margin collapsing. It was much more conceptual. So it was, I mean, they were much more human readable. But that, I think, is also why so many browsers at the time implemented things so incompatibly, because each engineer, you know, if an engineer is implementing margin collapsing, they're going to bring in assumptions, right? And it's going to be up to the way they interpret how these particular sentences are put together. And so, like, different browsers would do things differently. And so, yeah, I think that's a thing that was learned, was don't leave things so ambiguous.
Yeah. The test suite today is, every now and then when a new thing comes to the browser or to CSS, and if there is nothing but the spec and you want to see, like, what does this code actually look like? Sometimes it makes sense to just go into the test suite. You should, if you want to have a fun time, go take a look at the modern test suite, because the Flexbox and Grid test suite alone is just every single possible edge case that they could think of. And then they implement it and find discrepancies. So they write more. It's the same thing with test-driven development, right? You write a test that figures out, oh, that was a little edge case, and you try to go at it. It's absolutely massive today, isn't it?
Yeah. The web platform tests, which is where most of this lives, is just staggeringly huge. There's so much there. We were looking at that recently. I think there's literally over 1 million tests in total in web platform tests. not just for Grid, for everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are, like you say, there are tests are constructed and then implementations are done. And sometimes the implementers discover, oh, hey, this interacted in this weird way, or, well, like, we made this assumption and we're not the same as the other implementation by, like, this little bit. What should it be? That comes back to the working group. The working group makes a decision. Usually then a test case is written to cover that thing, whatever that decision was. And then, yes, it keeps sort of snowballing, as you said, in a good way, though. Especially because then, if you're the third or fourth implementer to implement a technology after it's sort of been through that whole process, you have all these tests. Not only do you have the detailed specification, but you have all these tests to test against. And you might, for that matter, be the person who goes through all of the tests and goes through the specification and then comes to the working group and says, so I found another situation that has not been covered, but, like, it's created weirdness. So, yeah, it keeps going like that. But yeah, there are so many tests, and it's interesting. There's sort of a dichotomy within web platform tests. Some of them are very JavaScript driven. Like, you just create these JavaScript based assertions, and either they pass or fail. And then there are visual tests where there's not only a test, but there's a reference rendering image that is supposed to be compared to, and there's supposed to be a pixel for pixel match. And you have to be careful which you use and which kind you use. And some of the older ones, like the JavaScript tests, are more recent. And then sometimes you can't use the JavaScript because it's purely a visual effect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It gets very complicated, but this is part of the reason why browsers are so much more consistent, like, interoperable than they used to be.
Yeah. Just like weird little edge cases where, like imagine you have an image with an auto width inside of a container query, which is inside of a grid that has a flexible width. You know, like, there's all these, I do not envy the person that has to go through this, like, who came up with this edge case and try to figure out how to duplicate it and to put it in. It's wild to think about all the possible edge cases. And then you have to go into the, like, low-level language that the browser rendering engine is written in and figure out how to catch those specific use cases.
It's funny because Wes and I were going in a very similar spot. I was just thinking about the conversation around container queries long before they arrived and how we talked about them existing and potentially existing and then, you know, just kind of disappeared for a little while. And then it just makes me think, like, it's kind of a miracle that anything is able, like, that complex is able to get added to the platform and all this stuff just works. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and a lot of that is this test, implement, test, implement, test, implement, discuss, implement, churn, that in a sense that we were just talking about. Because then by the time things come out from behind the developer flags, like the experimental web features flag in Chrome, the similar flags in Firefox, or the Safari technology preview builds, by the time stuff has come out from there, it's already been through this process of sort of iterative testing and implementation and refinement. So I feel like the first major recipient of that process was CSS Grid, which shipped in three major engines in the space of a month in 2017 and was in the fourth major engine at that time by the end of that same year. Because at the time we had four engines. And that was because there had been this sort of churn of, okay, we decided this. The two browser teams, two or three, however many browser teams went off and implemented what we decided, but they came to different conclusions, or like the way grid track sizing interacts with the regular box model sizing has like these bizarre situations, and so we gotta clarify that, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not the last of those. And sort of the last major technology I can think of that didn't benefit from that was Flexbox, which many of us remember as, Flexbox, that technology that like didn't work for half a decade. And
yeah,
a lot of us still sort of reflexively avoid it because it was so sort of buggy between implementations, but it didn't have this process at the time that it started to ship, whereas Grid did. And a lot like container queries is another example of a major technology that has benefited from that process, so that by the time it comes out, it's pretty stable. It's not like nothing's perfect. It's not perfect. There will still be bugs. There will still be refinements. But like it comes out from behind the flags, and you can kind of, if you're in a situation where you're working on an intranet project and you know what the browser base is going to be, and you know that that browser base is going to have that container query support, you can just do it. And if you are not in that situation, you still have, supports, feature queries to do the, hey, if you support container queries, here's a whole bunch of stuff for you. And if you don't, then, you get a non-container query version and it's okay, but it's not as like awesome as it could be.
Is this the reason why it seems like things are coming a lot faster nowadays? I mean, it does feel like container queries popped up and now we can use them and we ship them on our site. It just seems like stuff is dropping really fast nowadays.
Yeah, I think part of it is this. Part of it is that there are some really committed drivers of things. So container queries owe a lot to Miriam Suzanne, who drove that process, and kept shepherding it through the sort of the iterative loop. And
yeah, the ideas and feedback cycles.
Right. And had a good design to start with, right? Like had this proposal that was a pretty good design. It's, not necessarily exactly what came out the other side, but started with a good design because Miriam is super smart and knows a ton about CSS. And so there have been other things like that. The has pseudo class, which has just come out. Like that's an idea that's been around almost since CSS was CSS. And the problem was always performance, but eventually sort of somebody understood, hey, here's how we could fix this performance problem or how we could deal with this so that you don't grind browsers to a halt trying to select ancestors. But yes, I think that's part of it. And a lot of it is just, there's a lot of interest in, from the various stakeholders in pushing CSS forward. There are a number of people from various engine makers on the CSS working group who participate in that conversation, who, you know, sort of carry major parts of CSS in their heads. And so in the discussions, if someone says, yeah, I'm concerned about how this will interact with that, they're able to say, oh, good point, or that's not going to be a problem because of this other thing, right?
I was just going to ask you that, like, how many of the people on CSS working group are also people that write the code to implement it? Because, like, it's one thing to think of a design, and that's a very hard thing to do, is how do you design a language? And then the other part is, how do you actually implement it so that it paints to the page? So it's good to know there's several people on there that...
I would say a fair portion. It's not...
Okay.
Probably not a majority. I could be wrong about that. But it's a fair number of people. With CSS, I'm also going to give credit to preprocessors, like Sass and Less. Because in many cases, things that have been done through preprocessors and through the extensions or mixins or whatever the hell they're called. I don't actually use preprocessors myself, not because I think that they're terrible. I just don't. But people, you know, will create mixins or the language itself will have something like nesting of selectors, right? So yeah. Sass has, you can nest your selectors so that instead of having to write out the whole chain of whatever, you just put your inside the section block, you also put H1, right? And then the preprocessor spits out the section, blah, 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 section H1, blah, 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 right? That kind of stuff. That's coming to native CSS because it was shown to be so incredibly popular and powerful in preprocessors that the working group was able to say, well, here, like, clearly there's a use case. There's a demand for this. We can make it native. And we also have, like, a path has already been blazed, right? The trail has been marked. We may not be able to follow that trail exactly for technical reasons, but, like, there's already a reference implementation there that we could look to and say, do we do exactly that? Or do we do something very, very similar to that, but it's changed in this one way because of, you know, the CSS1 parsing rules are still in effect. And when they were written 28 years ago, whatever, nobody thought about nesting selectors. Or do we have to go a completely separate direction? It'll be this completely different syntax that'll have the same result, but it doesn't look anything like the same. As it turns out, the working group, in the case of selector nesting, has essentially followed what preprocessors have done, I think, with a tweak here or there. But they,
so it's so close, like, it's amazing, like, that we saw the iterations over the years, and we had a few episodes of, like, oh yeah, you have to put an ampersand in front, and there's these little gotchas, and all of those gotchas went away to a point where a SaaS dev can just sit down and start, with maybe like a 5-minute little pep talk, can start writing nested CSS.
That was, I will say, a long and contentious debate as to whether or not it was advisable or even, like, possible to get exactly the same syntax. And there were very strong opinions on, I would say, both sides, except I don't think there were just two sides. And there were real concerns from the SAS community. You know, one of the voices was, if you do your syntax exactly like SAS does its syntax, like, that could cause breakage. I don't remember exactly, but like, the SAS community, the actual core programming team of SAS, had very strong opinions on, you know, how to do the syntax in native CSS in order to avoid problems with actual SAS websites or SAS-driven websites. And also within the working group, leaving that aside, there were people who said, you know, there should always be an ampersand, or everything has to be in an at nest block, you know, in order to not create future problems, or in order to not create problems for past browsers, or both. And then there were other people who said, no, it should be as simple as possible. It really needs to be a very straightforward syntax. And that was a long debate. And like you say, if you just watch sort of the each version of the editor's draft of the specification, you would see that syntax changing, which is a reflection of that debate.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were like entire hour-long working group calls that ended up, even though there was an agenda that had many items on it, basically ended up just being, we're going to argue about nested selectors. And it's sometimes it goes on for a really long time because there is that whole, there's sort of that, here's a concern. And everyone else says, yeah, that's a real concern. We all need now have to go away and think about that and see if we can figure out a way forward that will not create problems for authors, right? Because
yeah. I appreciate those people doing that though, because the alternative is you ship this thing and everybody goes, oh, why didn't they do X, Y, and Z? And then people go, oh, like, I'm not actually going to use the real CSS version because it's not, it doesn't cover these use cases. And I feel like CSS nesting nailed it. Like, some people had some really long conversations about it, but
fingers crossed that they nailed it, because one of the concerns was, if we ship it so it looks exactly like SAS, in 5 years, will we regret that decision?
Yeah. Well, here's another question I have on the same vein is, like, in JavaScript, we got jQuery, right? Like, we query selector, all of that stuff. And now we have SAS-ish in CSS. And one of the big things that's incredibly popular right now that I don't think is just a fad is the fact that people like to write Tailwind and they like to write their CSS inline. And I think aside from you don't like the classes and it's too much to muddy up your HTML, the thing that people like about it is that you can write it inline where you're actually doing your templating. So my question is two-part to you. A, what do you think about that? And B, do you think we're ever going to see an extension of inline CSS to do all that Tailwind has?
I'm going to defer on the second question because I don't know that I could say what all Tailwind has.
Okay.
But on the first part, what do I think about that?
It's a spicy topic.
Yeah. And my spicy take is that a bunch of us spent a lot of years learning why inlining all of your style is a terrible idea, and that the cascade is actually your friend and not your enemy. And because there was a fad for a while, this is many years ago, where everything would be element style equals blah, 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 blah. And like the main style sheet would have almost nothing in it. That turned out to be really fragile and unmaintainable and terrible performance-wise, at least at the time. Mm-hmm. And so for me, instinctively, if you're trying to inline everything, whether it's with class names or not, if everything inline to me is not, it's not efficient and it's not, I don't think it's maintainable. Now, I know that there are people who use Tailwind and say it's the most maintainable my CSS has ever been. And if that's the case, like, I guess thumbs up. The little that I've done with Tailwind, it just does not work for me. But Jeremy Keith had a really good post a month or two ago about, you know, for some people, thing X, Tailwind, React, whatever it is going to really mesh with how they approach things. And so that's probably a good tool for them. And for other people, it's going to be like kryptonite, basically, to their way of doing things. And so don't use that tool. I mean, you know, certainly you can have debates about, you know, does this tool make this site too heavy? Does it make it non-performant? Like, does it slow everything down for whatever reason? Those are absolutely sort of objective measures you can look at and say, is this tool good or bad in a given situation? But sort of at a assuming, if you make, for the sake of argument, the assumption that they all have the same performance and weight outcomes, which of course they don't, but for the sake of argument,
yeah,
then it really comes down to, like, what works for you? Like, what makes sense to you? What lets you realize what you're envisioning, you know, more quickly and more completely?
Yeah. And I think JavaScript is at that point where there's parts of JavaScript you might never use because you prefer not to use it. But I don't think CSS is there, right? Like there's most of CSS. Oh, maybe. I'd like to hear your opinion on that. But like most stuff that gets added to CSS, I go, ah, yeah, I can use this.
I think certainly recently that's been largely the case.
Yeah, maybe not print CSS.
Ouch.
Oh. Well, actually, I actually wrote a book once and I did the whole thing in print CSS. So I have an encyclopedic knowledge of all of the print CSS.
I use a lot of print CSS for receipts wise.
Nice. Yeah. There are sort of some odd corners. And I can see someone saying, yeah, I'm never going to use animations. Maybe I'll use transitions, but I'm never going to use animations. Or at least not without, you know, being dragged to it. There's a renewed effort to get styles, basically CSS for speech. So if you have a speaking browser or a screen reader or whatever, you would be able to provide styling information to like raise the volume on strong elements or headings, right? Or to, instead of raising the volume, deepen the pitch or, you know, and please nobody take anything I just said as, oh, CSS is going to let you change volume and pitch because maybe that doesn't happen.
We're going to clip that.
Right. No, you can keep it in because there, there was long ago CSS for exactly that. And almost nothing ever supported it. Like Emacs W3 is the only implementation I'm aware of that supported Oral CSS, as it was called. But that idea is coming back around now. And it probably, they're not going to just revive Oral CSS, which is what I was referring to there. But there is definitely renewed interest in being able to provide styling cues for spoken content or for audio content, really. So, you know, another thing that the audio CSS used to be able to do was you could, in the same way that you can have before and after generated content, you could put audio cues before and after something. So you could put little dings before and after your hyperlinks, let's say, or you could put a little fanfare trumpet before an H1 or whatever. And so maybe that comes back because there are a lot, like the amount of content that's consumed in that manner of being read aloud by a machine is growing. And if Apple's bet pays off and Vision OS, that sort of thing becomes a major deal,
there's
probably going to be even more spoken content because you probably, if you're in an environment, you want to be able to hear content. You don't want to be, you know, have the monitor strapped to your face just to read documents, most likely. So, you know, I would want Wikipedia pages read to me rather than me having to sit there in a chair completely unaware of anything around me reading a document.
I found the link, by the way, to the Aural CSS press release from 1998. I'll link up in the episode so people can give that a read.
Yeah, there we go.
I want to keep going on that theme of just like alternative spaces where CSS may run. Because you work for Agalia. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
And often the reason why I first came, it was many years ago on the podcast, we were talking about where else does WebKit run? And Brian, he's like, hey, like we've actually implemented, often browser vendors will hire or companies will hire Agalia to implement features in the different engines. Because they need it for their product. So I'm curious, like, do you have any interesting examples of where the web is running on other than just like you sit down in front of your computer or open up a browser on your phone?
So many. The Sony PlayStation runs on WebKit.
Really?
As an example.
Like, what part of it?
The browser or the whole thing.
I don't want to get into too much details, but like it's WebKit. There are kitchen appliances that run on embedded WebKit. There are set-top boxes that like cable set-top boxes where the interface is SVG, not necessarily WebKit.
Really?
But it's SVG. And so,
you're paging down through the channels and you get that like old school, that's SVG.
At least for some of them. I'm not going to say for all of them, but some of the work that Igalia did at one point was improving the performance of SVG rendering for that use case.
Wow.
Most automotive entertainment displays are some form of embedded computer, often Linux, but not always, and usually using web technology to render the interface. The SpaceX's Dragon capsule, the big panels with the interfaces, it's Chrome. That's Chrome and JavaScript.
Vue, I remember. I remember Evan Yu was like, my code is running on a spaceship.
Yeah. On a spaceship.
The James Webb Space Telescope uses a 20-year-old version of JavaScript to manage its tasks.
Seriously?
Yep. 100%. 100% yes. Yeah. The real question is, where is web technology not?
Yeah.
And it's mostly in buggies. And I think maybe kitchen knives. Probably not using web technology.
That's amazing.
Not yet, at least.
Not yet. Probably somebody has shipped like auto sharpening knife block with a little LED screen, and it's probably running WebKit or Chrome or whatever, right? In the embedded flavor.
Yeah, I had talked to somebody at a conference once, and he worked for an elevator company. And you know, sometimes you visit these fancy elevators, and there's a little screen, and you can select what floor you want to go to,
and it tells you which elevator to go to.
Yeah. running embedded Chrome, pretty sure. And it's amazing all of the spots that it goes to. And I always love seeing that. Like, I used to collect photos of blue screens of death in hilarious places.
I still do.
Because I always thought that was really fascinating. But now I'm starting to see it's not blue screens of death. It's Chrome pop-ups or the bookmark bar popped down by accident. And
DevTools bar or something.
Yeah, you're at like a fast food restaurant. And all of a sudden you see like a little Chrome warning on it. And there's just, it just pops up absolutely everywhere. And so Igalia will be hired to implement some of those features. And I'm always curious about that. Like, Apple has been killing it in the CSS realm a lot lately. And they seem to be sort of erratic with like being the first to implement a lot of stuff. And I often wonder, and I'm curious if you know anything about that. Is that because they're like, oh, we need the new CSS color profiles for something, so they throw it in there so that they can use it. Is that why, or is it just because they're being a good steward of the web?
You know, it can be both. And I would say the same about the Chrome team or the Gecko team, for that matter. You know, being first is often a matter of what do we have a business case for, and an engineer who's available and willing to do the thing. Right. So like with HAZ, some of the initial implementations were actually done by Igalia in Chrome. Well, Chromium, technically, because it wasn't shipping in Chrome. But that's like the prototype implementation. Igalia was hired to do that by the company that creates Adblock Plus. So IO, it's EYEO, but IO. So they hired Igalia because they wanted a parent selector, an ancestor selector, and Byungwoo Lee, who's an Igalia employee, did that initial sort of prototype implementation of Chrome. But at the WebKit team, there was an engineer who was really interested, apparently, in doing it, and so implemented it, and WebKit actually shipped HAZ first, just because of where things fell in development cycles and yada, yada, yada. But just because there was someone available and they were able to, I'm sure they were able to justify it to their management, right?
Yeah.
And the same thing happens at Chrome. On the Chrome team, they see a technology that there's a demand for, and they can justify it to management. So, they're out in front on Vue transitions, because Vue transitions, there's a case to be made for implementing that. Here's how we could use that at Google. You know, we can have better view transitions in Google Docs or Google Maps or whatever. So, you know, I mean, the WebKit team has certainly been revitalized of late, I think. They've got a lot better DevRel thanks to Jen Simmons.
Yeah, we've been trying to get her on the show. Maybe you can get us an in.
I mean, she works for Apple, so good luck.
Yeah.
Which is very similar as, you know, trying to get someone from Google on. That can be a challenge depending on who you're trying to get and what they want to talk about. But anyway, and both companies, actually all companies, but since we're talking about Google and Apple, they both hire firms like Agalia to implement stuff sometimes because maybe they have the business case for it. They really do want it implemented quickly, but they don't have the engineering resources. Like, they don't have an engineer who's knowledgeable enough to do the thing and is also available and isn't already committed to other stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, Agalia, we did off-screen Canvas implementation in WebKit. Not, I think, because Apple didn't think off-screen Canvas was useful. They just didn't have someone available. And so they were willing to hire outside. You know, in Chromium, we did the Has, and we've done other things as well. And that's, it's kind of an underappreciated part of the ecosystem, I think, that it's not just the WebKit and Chromium and Gecko teams doing this stuff. They don't have infinite resources. And, you know, people look at Google and Apple and are like, there's no excuse. They have the money to implement anything they want.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works, right? Apple is not the WebKit team. Apple is way more than the WebKit team. Google is not the Chromium team. There's so, you know, the browser engine teams are tiny parts of those companies that still, like, they draw a goodly amount of resources, but they don't have the full resources of the company. Google does not give all of their revenue to the Chromium team. They'd probably love it, but
yeah, they would absolutely
we don't love it because they could hire a, you know, a kajillion programmers and implement all kinds of web standard stuff that's waiting, because there's always an infinite number of things that could be added to the platform. We've been seeing that with the Interop 2024 discussions and the Interop effort in general, where this year there were, I think, just over 100 proposed things to tackle in Interop. You got to remember, the first year of Interop, there were 5 areas of implementation, right? And then the next year there were more, and the next year there were more. But there were over 100 proposals. That was quickly cut down to just over 70. Because some of the proposals were, this would be a really cool technology to implement. No specification, no working group. You just, it would be awesome if browsers did this. It's like, you're right.
Yeah.
But this is not where you figure that out, right? This is not the group for that. So it was cut down to 71, and then it's been getting winnowed down further because there's no way that any browser team could handle all 71 of those topic areas in the space of a year. It's just not feasible. So that has to just keep getting, it has to be winnowed down. And there are going to be proposals in Interop 2024, the same way they were in Interop 2023, that are just, they're not accepted for the sole reason of, we already have these other things.
Yeah.
And that's, we're not even, you know, like, we're not 100% confident we can even do all of those in the space of a year. We just don't have room for any more. And, you know, topic A just has more buy-in from the various browser vendors than topic T or whatever.
Well, I don't think anyone's complaining about the rate at which stuff is dropping in the browser these days. It seems like every single day we get something new. Well,
there's a few people complaining it's coming too fast, which I always, I kind of appreciate, because there was a very long time where it was, I will never complain about any technology I get. And then, you know, one of the conversations we've been having recently is how do you get the word out about new technologies, right? If a new thing is dropping, how do you keep up? Because there's no way, nobody can keep up with everything.
Except for Scott and I.
But even at that, do you know everything that the HTML working group has been discussing about HTML in the last year? Do you know?
No. Often we find ourselves pawing through meeting notes just to give updates on things.
Yeah.
So that's one way to do it, certainly, is to figure out where the various meeting notes are published, which ones are worth following. And then, you got to set aside an hour every week or 2 hours or whatever it is to go through those meeting notes. Like the CSS working group, after every call on the blog, they publish the resolutions from that meeting, which is a really nice way to sort of be able to keep up. It's like, oh, this week the working group had 4 resolutions and they were about these things. And there's a link to each of the issues. So if you want to go read the more detailed conversation, you certainly can do that. But you know, what is TC39 up to? What is coming in ECMAScript? And there are a lot of places you can go to find this information, but just trying to keep up with just that, all of the things you could possibly try to keep up with, that's nearly a full-time job.
Yeah.
And nobody's paying for that. It turns out you can't really make a salary on that unless, you know, I suppose somebody could set up a Patreon and maybe make that work. But
yeah,
that's the struggle. And, you know, people listen to podcasts like Syntax. And hopefully a thing that you are interested, that you would be interested in, somebody talks about. But it's so hard to keep up. And that's a challenge Brian Cardell, my colleague, who you referred to earlier, this challenge Brian and I think about, how do we just make people aware that thing exists? Bruce Lawson is a colleague and friend. He occasionally does these he calls them reading notes. They're just sort of here are things that caught my eye in the last however long it's been. And recently, I think his most recent one of the things he had in the middle of it was a link to an article about the isolation CSS property. And he said, I didn't even know that existed, right? Isolation's been there a long time, and it's not Bruce's fault that he didn't know. It's just one of those, when I see that, I think, oh yeah, isolation. Dude, clearly you didn't read my book, which I get because it's 1,100 pages, but it's in there. You could find it if you looked far enough in there, but how would you even know to look? You don't know how to look. And container queries, there are people probably who maybe someone comes across this podcast and they're like, container, I have no, what's container queries? I need to go look that up, right?
And even if they've heard of it, that there's there's no guarantee they're going to go any further or even use it. We hear all the time people who, I learned Flexbox, I don't have enough time to learn Grid now, even though Grid is a game-changing layout technology for CSS. So even simply hearing about it or knowing about it isn't even a barrier to knowing how to use it. But that's it. We've been gifted all of these amazing new features in CSS, right? Kind of like dream features, from container queries to the has selector, those types of things. Is there a particular dream feature of CSS that you have that does not exist, or was it one that has been added?
Most of them have been added. So there's one that I've wanted for a really long time. This is going to seem to fly completely in the face of something I said earlier in this very podcast. But style equals, right, in the HTML, style equals blah, 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 blah. More than 20 years ago, Danielle Glossman and I proposed style equals at import URL blah. And then you would import that style sheet, and it would only apply to that subtree.
Scope styles?
Essentially, yes. Which are coming back. Now we have at scope. That's a proposal, which could let you do a very similar thing. But that's a thing that I would like to see, mostly for the same reasons that styles are scoped in Shadow DOM. I want to be able to say this snippet apply to this subtree. And yes, at scope hopefully is coming. It's still being discussed. Another one is, and this goes way back, text a line and then a string. So in a table column, for example, if you have a table column that has a bunch of numbers and some of them have decimals and some don't, you say text a line, and then in quotes, you put the period, and then everything is lined up on the decimal.
Mm. Ah.
I had to come up with an entire like hack around using transforms in order to approach this capability when I was putting a book online a year and a half ago. and yeah, I would just like to be able to do that. I'm sure there's something that I'm thinking. Oh, hanging punctuation. Chris Collier just wrote about that recently. But for years, I've been saying, can we please just have hanging punctuation in more than WebKit? Because it's really nice, especially if you're trying to create your presentation slides using HTML and CSS. Hanging punctuation is super useful because then you can put stuff in quotes and the sides of your text block line up and the quotes can hang out into the margin or padding or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think the other one that I think we sort of have and sort of don't is marker styling. So list bullets and counters and stuff like that. There's some ability to style markers, but it's not as nearly as complete as it should be. But I mean, you could tell I'm kind of grasping for sort of these little quality of life improvements as opposed to like fundamental features.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Here's the one that I think is more than a quality of life improvement. Color mixing, like you can do in SAS, which again, that's being prototyped in CSS. So ideally it's coming natively where you can do a, you know, I have a color and then for this other, in this other place, I want the color to be 40% darker or 20% lighter. Or I want to mix that color with opacity so that I don't actually have to say, you know, RGBA, whatever, and specify the opacity. I can just say, give me that color that I had before that I already defined.
Yeah.
But mix it to be a little you know, a bit translucent, like 50% translucent. But that's another situation where the working group looked at things people were doing in LESS and SAS and said, that's a thing people really like to do. And it's clear how that is actually convenient for authors. Like it makes their CSS sort of more robust and less sort of weird.
Yeah. And wouldn't that be great if we could get that with CSS variables, right? Dynamically updating, right? Compared to the on build time. Yeah.
Like I've seen people do the thing where they have one variable specifies like the HSL values and another variable specifies the alpha. And then they have a third variable that puts the two together. So you've got the two variables in your variable. And then like they can manipulate things and sure you can do that, but God, that's just spaghetti code.
We're doing it on our syntax site and it is, it stinks. Yeah.
It's spaghetti style. Whereas it would be great to just say, all right, here's our blue. And then over here, I'm going to say this blue, but change the alpha channel or for that matter, given the proposals that are happening now, this color, but change the H, change the hue, right? So you can color shift, you can hue shift the color without having to like rewrite it. I really want to see that come and be as full featured as it's looking right now, because it will really make manipulating colors and stuff like that a lot easier.
I have a demo where, and I think it only works in Safari right now, but it's you give it one color and the entire website is computed from that one color, because you can break out the H, S, and L values and you can throw them into calc and whatnot. But man, like that's something that we've been waiting for forever. We've had several shows over the years about kind of updating where it's at.
Where it's at now is it's being debated and people are doing sort of initial prototypes and hopefully it will all come together.
Let's move into the next section, which is our supper club questions. We just got a couple questions we want to quick fire ask you.
First one is, which browser are you using?
My daily driver is Firefox Nightly.
Ooh, Nightly. Wow.
I like to live on the bleeding edge of technology. No, actually I don't, but it's actually Nightly because that's where like the initial implementations of container queries or whatever show up. And so that gives me a chance to test them out and maybe find problems or at least understand them before they sort of hit the main public release. So that's why I'm on. And I prefer Firefox to Chrome. It's always been good to me. And
as a follow-up to that, I've been a Firefox user for probably about 8 years now, big fan of it. Any thoughts on the fact that like Mozilla had cut quite a bit of funding? We talked earlier about the fact that these like there's not a ton of devs working on this stuff, and it probably kills them to see people being like, oh, Firefox is the new IE. And these people are working really hard on it. And at the end of the day, there's only so much funding for these developers to implement features. So any thoughts on that, where there's, at least in my head, there's a possibility that we could go down from three browsers down to two at one point?
Oh, there's a real possibility, unfortunately.
Oh, I don't like hearing them say that.
So this could be a whole other show.
Okay.
So the entirety of web technology advancement is built on Google Ad Revenue. All of it.
Yeah.
And I'm including WebKit. Because if you look at what Google pays Apple every year for the default search deal, like it's billions of dollars. I'm pretty sure the WebKit team is not getting billions of dollars, even though they really should. They've been able to hire a bunch of people, but I don't think that they have billions of dollars worth of employees. Maybe I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, someone let me know. But same thing with Gecko. The Mozilla Foundation gets a bunch of money from Google for the default search deal, and that's most of their funding. And if that ever goes away, I don't see how Gecko continues. And maybe it will never go away, but you know, that's what people said about AOL and MySpace. So
the amount of times people are using AI to ask questions rather than quickly Google something is, I foresee that happening, unfortunately.
Yeah. So if the Google ad market collapses for some reason, AI, whatever, you know, FTC trade, they get broken out, who knows? Right. Yeah. Like the entire ecosystem rests on that one thing, basically. Now, there are tiny glimmers of the possibility of something else. So, Andreas Kling, I don't know if you've been following Serenity OS and the Ladybug browser that he's implementing.
A little bit, yeah.
But he does not have a default search deal with Google, as far as I'm aware. Because, you know, Google doesn't hand billions of dollars to just anybody, sadly, because I could sure use some money. But anyway, well, I could use $1 billion.
Because
I have a lot of charities I'd like to support. But anyway, moving on. he basically is crowdfunding that and has gotten some pretty hefty sponsorships. Now, could Firefox run on that? I don't know. Thunderbird does, right? That's a Mozilla product. The Thunderbird mail client pretty much runs off of, donations. It runs off of effectively Patreon. I don't think they specifically use Patreon itself, but they're community funded. They're crowdsourced, essentially. They're crowdfunded. Could Firefox be crowdfunded? Could WebKit be crowdfunded? I don't know. We got real used to everything being free. And, you know, we were talking about Netscape Navigator at the beginning of the show. That originally was a $40 product. You paid $40.
Oh,
you got a...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you paid $40 at Babbage's or whatever. You got a box. Like, remember software box? Remember when software came in boxes, like cardboard boxes? And there was a manual inside and a disc and stuff? That was Netscape Navigator originally. It was free to educational institutions, probably also government institutions. There might have been other free, but it was a $40 piece of software, you know, at a time when $40 was more than it is now, like in terms of purchasing power.
That's still a lot of money to to spend on some software right now.
Right. So like if you went to people and said, I got a new, like, let's say Arc said, okay, we're exiting the VC phase. It's now $40 a year. Yep. How many people would pay for Arc? I don't know.
Yeah, we had them on the show, and they did mention that that was the intention eventually.
So
yeah.
If that's where they're going to go, then we're going to find out. Can a browser, and in that case, it's really, can a UI team be supported? Because they're not writing their own browser engine. It's Chrome. So, if you had a product like that that's run off of WebKit, which can be done, and Apple decides they don't want to implement WebKit anymore, 10 years from now, what do? Do you move to Chromium? Do you assume that Google will always want to run Chrome, that there will always be that funding there? These are hard questions. And just to say to people, hey, I think you should pay actual money every year or even just once for a web browser, people would just look at you like you proposed that they sell their children. Right? Because browsers are free. What's wrong with you? It's like, no, they're not free. They're completely subsidized by Google. And is that a good thing? I could, make pretty strong arguments that it's not. And yet I don't necessarily see a way out of that. So
the good news for Firefox is that they seem to have fans. And like, that's the type of audience you need to pay for something. We make any post on any of our social medias about Chrome, and it's filled with people saying, never use Chrome. I'm only going to use Firefox till I die. And like, those are the people that will maybe pay for your thing, but it's still a big ask.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, people can donate to the Mozilla Foundation now.
Yeah.
But how many of the people in your replies actually do that?
Yeah.
Some of them I'm sure do. And, mad respect for the ones that do, but I'm guessing not nearly all of them. And would they? Probably if they had to, but they don't have to. And if it ever gets to the point where they really have to, will it be too late? And I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's get to the part of the show where we talk about sick picks and shameless plugs. Do you have a sick pick for us today?
Do I have a sick pick? I'm going to go with Polypane.
Oh, yeah. Big fan.
Yeah. Specifically because I learned just yesterday there's sort of an implicit feature in it that I didn't know about, which is if you turn off navigation syncing, then you can load up two different URLs and then scroll them, like link scroll them, and even link to interact with them. So I was trying to compare like a conversion. Brian Cardell actually just did a post about this. He had taken this book that I had put online last year, and where I used MathJax, and he had converted the MathJax to MathML. Right. I used tech syntax. He converted it all to MathML, and I wanted to see like what do they look like side by side. And so I put up on the socials, hey, does anyone know of a thing like Polypane that lets you do link scrolling of two completely different URLs? And Killian Volkoff said, actually, Polypane can do that. Here's how.
Man, he's so fast.
It can do everything.
He's so fast.
Yeah.
It really can. So Polypane is my sick pick for many reasons. That's just the most recent.
Cool. Yeah, I love Polypane.
And what about a shameless plug?
I mean, we've talked about Agalia, who does employ me at agalia.com, but I will also shamelessly plug meyerweb.com, which is my little outpost in the digital ocean, not the host, the great vast sea of the web. Meyerweb.com is just sort of where I still blog, and the blog still has comments enabled, and I plan to never turn them off because I really like comments, and usually the comments on my posts are high value. I actually learn things out of them. So that's where I tend to hang out personally. I'm doing an advent calendar this year for the first time.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate all of your time. And this was such a treat.
What about you guys? Where's your sick picks?
We do them on the Wednesday show. This is a Friday show.
All right.
We just did them a minute ago. Mine was gochujang sauce, and Wes's was
some kimchi thing. A Korean kimchi seasoning that you could put on popcorn.
God, you guys went culinary, and I was all digital. Okay, that's fine.
No, we go all over
the
place.
We often go digital. Yeah, I feel like I've sick picked Polypane at least once. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, very much in the wheelhouse.
Yeah, yeah. We just had a issue with our OpenGraph images not being scraped properly on LinkedIn, and LinkedIn Polypane helped us figure out some of the issues around that. So big fan of that software.
Good job, Killian.
Yeah, I just messaged him telling you sick picked it.
Nice.
All right. Well, thanks again. Appreciate all your time. I hope you have a great day.
Yeah, thanks. You too. Thanks for having me on. It was great.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.